Good evening. I'm a bit speechless actually after that. I was going to say to Muazzam that I've heard your story so many times, I don't want to hear it again. I'm falling asleep. But
try being me.
My name is Adnan Siddiqui. I'm actually director at CAGE, where Muazzam is our outreach director. I'm also very privileged to meet Ashish Kadiali, who was the director of this film as well. I really just want to go straight into questions because I had loads and loads of questions. In fact, I'm going to use speaker's privilege to ask the first one. But please, you know, make the opportunity. But the first question really I wanted to ask you, Ashish, is why is it called a confession? It's almost like it's, you know, I sort of even felt it looked like, with Muazzam's reflection, it was like a Catholic kind of, you know, the booth and you've got the priest that you're talking to. And, you know, you're going to get say Hail Marys at the end of it.
Yeah, I hadn't really been thinking about the that being a confession. What's the story about? You know, and the story is about you know, for me the forced confession at the heart of it. You know, did the Muazzam's story? I mean, the public interest in Muazzam is the story of someone who's confessed to being a member of Al Qaeda. But you know, the film is about trying to understand the circumstances. That confession in more detail.
I said I was going to try and avoid the Melvin Bragg kind of artistic kind of merit, but I mean that was the thing that we often see that Cage and also with Muazzam, you just have to go onto Wikipedia. That seems to be the way that the courts and everyone rely. They just look at he confessed to being part of Al Qaeda, and that's it, and it just follows you around. So there's no smoke without fire, but. You know, I'm just interested that listening and hearing that was, you know, it was very powerful. It was very powerful. And like I said, you there are quite a few insights there. And, you know, I don't know what others think or if there people wanted to chip in or ask.
That was an excellent film, by the way. I really enjoyed that. And I think I wouldn't sort of comment on the artistic side of it, but certainly the contents and very sort of the way the storyline flew, covered it went really quickly, and I think it covered quite a lot. One of the questions that really, the points that really sticks in my mind that I really must ask now was that you're saying that after each experience in Bagram, Kandahar, Guantanamo, your humanity has been enhanced. Could you elaborate on that?
The old saying that if it doesn't break you, it makes you, comes to mind. And that's because they tried numerous times on numerous occasions to break us as prisoners in many forms, many ways, tell us that there's no hope, that there's no one who cares about us. But every time I found that beyond what I couldn't see the families, I couldn't see my father campaigning, I couldn't see friends, relatives, I couldn't see Cage, I didn't know they even existed. But what I did know was that even there, right in the heart of the beast, were individuals, soldiers, even some interrogators, sometimes who would bring us little snippets of information that would be at great cost to themselves, but would give us a great deal of hope. And in that act, what they did was to solidify that view about my humanity has been enhanced, it hasn't been made worse. I could have, and many people could have come out from that experience embittered, filled with hatred, filled with anger, wanting vengeance, and you wouldn't blame them. Yet my experience hasn't been, it's not just mine, I say this often, I was only there for 3 years, my closest friend here in the UK right now, somebody who's held in Guantanamo for 14 years. 14 years. And he's not embittered and filled with hate and seeking vengeance. And this is a common theme amongst the prisoners, that their humanity was enhanced. And this is what really burns our detractors. It burns those who hate us. It burns those who try to harm us. Because in the end, our oppressors were not going to become our teachers. Our teachers are far greater than that.
Hi. First of all, congratulations for the film, because I think it's a very necessary film. to see. I wanted to ask you about the during the film you made this question a couple of times, but it wasn't clear to me in the beginning why you've been living in Britain, brought here. Why do you go back like to Turkey and then to Chechnya in the middle of the conflict? What brings you there as a young person, and how?
You're asking why do I go to any of these? Why do I travel? Why do I travel to any place?
Well, why you travel to specifically like where a place where is in war or was near to being
well,
war? Was
it yeah, so prior to Guantanamo, prior to the this part that's before 2005, I'm clear. I go to Bosnia because I want to help those who've been oppressed. I go to Afghanistan because I want to go and live in a society where I can help people. Help to build a school, help to build the walls, and so forth. After that, my journeys, my travel journeys that are not for holiday purposes, are specific. Now they've been shaped by my experience in Guantanamo, Bagram, and torture. So before, I wanted to go and help in the places that I did. This time around now, I'm going to seek answers to questions around complicity in torture, primarily the British government, but also the Americans. So I go to Libya, I go to Syria, I go to Egypt, I go to Kenya, I go to around the world. And that's almost entirely my role as outreach director of CAID, but also the investigations and trying to find out exactly to what extent our own government has been complicit in the torture of British citizens and citizens of other countries.
I can see very clear meeting you in the screen. I would love to talk to you about an hour or two. I can have thousands of questions, but
I don't think the rest of the audience will.
No. What I meant is as a person, I understand after the journey meeting you through the screen why a person like you, born with such a determination, nothing to do with what happened to you before as a young person. What brought you there? Apart from help, I thought of helping. I lived in Africa for a year, and I've been brought to Morocco. I never, I wanted to help. I went there, I built a school, I did something. I never had the courage, and I believe I have quite a lot of determination to go there, to leave everything behind, to help. What did you feel as a person? I'm more interested as a person, yourself, as that young person who went there. What
Part of it's a journey of discovery, and when you're at that age, you want to learn about the world beyond the borders of Spark Hill or Birmingham, wherever it is you happen to live, and you want to explore, you want to see the world, you want to learn more about it. There are people who like to enjoy to stay where they are. I'm not like that. I was never like that. I wanted to learn more about the world, and particularly the world that I was connected to, the world of Islam. And so that's when I had my awakening about being connected to the world of Islam. My obvious journeys then would take me to the world of Islam, where I wanted to find my own identity.
Thank you.
Thank you. I had the same question for both of you. How do you want people to respond to this documentary? Like, what do you want to get out of it? Mazin first, and then maybe Ashish.
I never really made the documentary. I just sat in on an interview or an interrogation, and that was it. The question really should go to Ashish. All I can say is, having seen it, in hindsight, I can say that one of the reasons why I support the film, even though I'm partially, lightly grilled in the film, is because it does allow a narrative to be told from a point of view that you don't often hear widely. Many people here may know my story, but many people around the country don't know the story. And it's not just my story. This is the voice of, literally, we say the voice of the voices of CAGE. It's decades of experience. It says living the war on terror. And it's not just me living the war on terror. We're all living the war on terror. We've all been affected by it in one way or the other. And it's just me telling it through the most vivid experience of my journey. Some people have said I'm almost like an Islamic Forrest Gump. And it's happened to be at all these different places. That may be true, I don't know, but I'll let Ashish answer the rest.
Yeah, I mean, I guess the kind of key thing for me is the war on terror. I think the war on terror has been a big problem for all of us. I'm not Muslim. I don't felt it as an Asian. But I think that the more I sort of take this film out into the world, the more I realise it's not just been a problem for Asians. It's been a problem for, you know, white British people. It's polarised our society, and it's kind of made fear this you know, real sort of central pivot of our national life, and globally as well. So I guess what that's done is also it's reinforced prejudices. It's made people very quick to judge one another. It's made a lot of Muslims very, you know, quick to judge Gorries. You know, it's made, no, and that's the language of it.
We have lots of Muslim Gorries, by the way.
that's the language of it across Britain. It's made a lot of British people, you know, very quick to judge Muslims, and we all suffer for that. So I guess what I was just trying to do was create a space that actually could bring people together to actually bring their own prejudices into the theatre, come in with your prejudices, sit down and be challenged, whoever you are. I want everyone to be challenged by the experience of watching the film.
Can I just add to that, that one of the things I'm pleased with this event is one of the few times as a director I haven't been running around looking for an alternative venue, because when you ask what can you do with this documentary, the film tour has been going for several months now, but almost every event that we have with Muslim speaking or any of us at Cage is the blessed officers of Prevent seem to want to close it down. So I think that it's important for you to put the word out there, because what I think causes problems, like Ashish is saying, we need to have uncomfortable conversations. You know, the word jihad is this word which lots of people don't understand, and it needs to be detoxified. But we need to have these conversations. Muslim previously was doing work, I think, with the Warrington Centre. It was a conflict recovery related to Irish republicanism and the Warrington bombs. And like I said to you, I'm a GP. I've lived and worked for 20 years. And for me, it's not about ideology. You know, I have victims of the nail bomber. I know people who died because of IRA bombs. It's not about ideology. It's about politics and how things change. And I think until we are allowed to talk, and this gives us venues to do that, the film will be out, I think, on iPlayer as well, and you know, you can get it on iTunes. Please do write about it, review it. You can be as critical as you want. You know, there's no problem. I've read some of the criticism. People say that Ashish was too kind to Muslim, wasn't being that, you know, interrogatory, considering he had 300 interviews by the CIA. I don't know what else they expected. but I think it's about opening up the discussion. At the moment, people are too scared to talk, and we need venues. We need these kind of discussions to be had. So I'd say to you, please do put your reviews. You know, it's the hashtag is the confession. Please do put it out there on social media. And blog, review, do whatever you want to, because, you know, the mainstream media may cut us down, but social media is ours.
Salman, first of all, I'd like to say jazakallah khair and thank you to Ashish for the amazing documentary. Just a quick question in regards to your journey to Syria. Was it Cage-related? And what was your specific goal for going to Syria? And did you get the answers to what you are seeking?
That's a very good question. It's important, but in all of that story of what's happening in Syria, ISIS and everything else, people forget. When I talk about how I was interrogated by the Americans in Bagram, and they threatened, they said, if you don't cooperate, we'll send you either to Egypt or to Syria. There was a reason why they said that. Anybody who knows the Muslim Arab world knows that these countries had mastered the arts of torture, and that there are numerous people, countless people, who have spoken about the types of torture they've endured there, including Western citizens from Canada, for example, Mar Arar and Abdul al-Maliki and others, who spoke in Syria how they've been tortured and placed in coffins while they were alive, beaten, raped, and abused. And this was way before the war that exists now. So they knew, the Americans knew full well, though they called Syria one of the countries as the axis of evil, how telling it is that the American government was quite prepared to work with countries practicing torture that they had targeted and labeled as supporters of terrorism. So when it came to Muslim terrorism suspects, everybody's our friends. And so my investigation took me to seeking, particularly in the case of Ibn Sheikh al-Libi, and then from there the leads that I found from Libya that connected to Syria. And in I have absolutely no doubt, completely 100%, that the Americans were sending over renditioning people that they had captured in Pakistan and beyond, and they were sending them directly to the Syrian regime. I know also of one case that involved the British government and the deception of evidence that led to the rendition of one individual. So I know this was happening for a fact, and this is what I was trying to pursue. Of course, in the midst of all that, there was a war taking place, so the priorities of the people that I spoke to were more about the war than about my investigations. But that's what led me to communicate and meet with a lot of those people.
Follow up to that. Do you intend to go back to Syria anytime soon?
Sorry, you know, one question per person, please. One thing I was just going to ask you is that it's not just for your popcorn and things like that, but in the drink holders, there's a leaflet for Cage, because actually Mwazzam is going to get grilled at the Intelligence Select Committee next month. And so some of his findings and things that they still think that obviously it's important to discuss and find out what his findings are. But Cage, you know, we are working together on these issues, and we do say that there has to be accountability, has to be accountable on both sides. Those people who are committing atrocities, who are committing terrorist atrocities, but also, you know, if the government is also accountable. So I would say to you that if you want to keep abreast of all the issues, don't just view this as just one documentary, that's where it ends. I think you'll have Confession Part 2 with Mwazzam, you know, what's it, I think it's Portcullis House.
Just to answer the first question, he did ask the question, he said, have I got any plans to go back to Syria soon? Yeah, if you go with me.
With a passport.
Assalamu alaikum. What are your hopes for the future, and how do you hope history will view you?
Well, I think the future should be bright, but I don't think it's orange. Those of you remember. Guys, you guys are slow. And
maybe you're not funny.
Why they're laughing. The other thing, sorry, your other question was, well, how do I want history to remember me? I mean, why should history remember me at all? You know, subhanAllah, my father, who's featured in this film, passed away literally almost 2.5 weeks ago. And if there's anything to be remembered, it's his legacy for me. It's his legacy. Why? Because there's a hadith, the saying of the Prophet ﷺ, said that when the son of Adam passes away, all his deeds end except for three. And they include a continuous charity, a pious son that prays for him, and knowledge that is beneficial to all. And so for me, everything that I've learned, everything that I've done, has been by the grace of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, and then through what my father taught me as a person, the principles, the rules, how to be, strength, honor, justice, and resilience. I learned it all from him. So if there's anything I want to be remembered for, it's what my father taught me. And I think that we often forget the role of our parents. You know, there's one thing we would have seen in all of this, and you'll be shocked that in a world that exists today, that there was a father who was like this. Not that he just stood up for his son. He never once said to me, Mwazzam, what you're doing is insane. What you're doing is wrong. Where you're going is not the sort of thing you should be doing. Not once. Yet he was a liberal man. Yet he was a well-connected man. Yet he was a banker. He was all those things. Not once did he say to me, Mwazzam, what you're doing is wrong. He was a conscious man. He was a decent man. and he knew what I was trying to do wasn't terrorism, wasn't extremism, it was the decent thing to do. And because there's not enough people doing the decent thing, we can't allow people with views that are indecent or undecent or wrong to prevail, simply because that happens to be the status quo. So I want to be remembered for the good that my father did for me, and anything that I did, any mistakes I made for myself.
Assalamu alaikum. Let me Allah grant your father the highest position in Jannah, inshallah. You mentioned sometimes there is a need to ask uncomfortable questions. This one, I won't be too uncomfortable. But there was two moments in the film where you were asked in an interview about being British. And naturally, whenever someone asks us if we're British, we perceive it to be a geographical issue. Yeah, we are British, we're from here. And the ending of the film as well ended with mentioning this idea or this identity about maybe loving where you're from or loving Britain. But my question is around, after the whole CTS Act, and now that they've tried to define this term being British, being linked to certain values, almost making it ideological, about tolerance, rule of law, democracy, etc. How do you now see yourself, knowing that, yeah, it's a geographical thing, but also now there's an ideological underpinning or assumption being made when someone asks us, are we British, to say that we are British now? Do you find it more of a challenge? And how would you go about addressing this topic today in society?
In all honesty, I don't find it a challenge at all. It's not challenging at all. The concept of Britishness to me is very clear. It's, there's a lot of Muslims in this audience, so let me, if you will, just give you some examples of from Islamic history why it shouldn't be a challenge. Some of the closest companions of the Prophet Muhammad Sallallahu Alaihi Wasallam were known by where they came from. And they happened to be even countries that sometimes that were at war with Islam. Salman al-Farsi, the Salman the Persian, Suhaib al-Rumi, Suhaib the man from Rome. We know them to this day by those names, not because of the places they migrated to. They weren't known as al-Madani or as Makki or al-Jazeera or whatever it is. They were still known by where they came from. And a person's, in my view, your identity, you can't escape it. The very fact that we're sitting here talking in English shows that we are connected to that part of the identity. The idea that Britishness is something that the government determines and imposes upon the people and says, these are British values. Yeah, I have a problem with that. I have a big problem with that. Because those values we've been told about, let's just take one. Belief in the rule of law. I mean, did you see in the entire story the application of the rule of law? No, it isn't. So by that definition, the government that was involved in that is extreme. So I don't take lessons from the government about what my identity is going to be. And I'm happy to call myself British because that's part of my physical, historical, psychological identity. My mother, my father, my sister, my friends are buried in British cemeteries. I can't do anything about that. That's where they are. My history was in these schools in this country. I've been born and raised, I've been put in prisons. Even my prison experience in this country is part of what I like and what I dislike. There are things about prison I liked. That's all part of being British for me. Mutual respect. Why is that only exclusively British? Why isn't that a Belgian value? Why isn't that a Dutch value? Why isn't that an Islamic value? And so, the Britishness argument, when the government tries to instill and enforce a view about what Britishness is, most people don't even know what that is, and they'll roll over laughing when they try to insist on what it is. But we can't deny where we are, who we are, and what that geography has made us, in my view.
I have a question for yourself, Mazem, and also the filmmaker, but with you, Mazem, if I could start. In the film, one gets the impression, or I got the impression, that what the Americans and the Brits were doing, particularly after you were released, was somehow motivated out of some sort of fear. Is that your view, or is it arrogance? Is it what the Americans and the Brits are doing around the world? Is that arrogance, or is that now fear? And the second part of the question is for the filmmaker, is that something you touched upon and tried to foster, or is that something that just naturally developed?
I think the issue about fear is very real. You see an animal, when an animal's frightened, it is its most dangerous when it is frightened. We're talking about human beings here, not animals. But essentially, I think the instinct was the same. But there is a level of arrogance. There is a level of arrogance that is supreme in their view, I think, in the view of the United States in particular, in Britain to some degree. And that is the rest of the world, the darker speaking people, the darker looking people of the world and so forth, must conform to our point of view. And there's a controversial example I want to give you, but it is an example to look at. When 9/11 happened, the United States asked for Osama bin Laden to be handed over. Now, bearing in mind, the Americans had no extradition treaty with the Taliban. They didn't even recognize the Taliban. So how could they expect that to happen? The Taliban said, produce some evidence. They went even further. They said, produce that evidence, bring some of your own Islamic scholars, there are plenty, American Islamic scholars, I mean, and bring them to Taliban courts and present your evidence. And there, if there's evidence against bin Laden or anybody else, we will prosecute him to the full letter of the law. They refused. They didn't even entertain the idea. And the question is, why not? Was it arrogance or was it fear? I think in that instance, it's arrogance to not even entertain the idea of anybody else's justice system, and just only your own great supreme. 9/11 was a shock for the United States of America. The people who it happened to, I don't believe they deserved it. But then I was in Afghanistan when the response to 9/11 happened, and we saw people butchered. The number wasn't even counted. They didn't even bother counting the dead, because the dead, and the dead don't count. Not at least if they're in those countries. So there is this sense of, yeah, we talk about equality, but some people are more equal than others.
Just can you clarify what the question for me was? Was that architecture of fear and arrogance part of my design?
They didn't actually come out. I read it.
I found that the only principle that could work for me. I mean, I like anyone else watching the film, and I sat through, you know, for almost a year. I just sat through both. I mean, 2 days with Mazen's story, then months and months just going over it and over it. But also then exposing myself to this entire archive, you know, really kind of sifting through 30 years of visual history. For me, the only principle that came to work was to suspend my own judgment and to try to, you know, try to acknowledge what I did not know, you know, what I do not know, you know, to understand that there was this balance around every point and every question, and that it was okay for me not to have the definitive answer to each and every point, because that, you know, I think is collectively the truth of where we're at. As things kind of developed, the kind of emotional story that I want to tell really was one about justice and about the fact that what really emerged for me from the archive material was that everyone is claiming that they're speaking on behalf of justice. You know, everyone. That's what conflict is, right? Everyone thinks that they're right, someone else is wrong. And I really wanted to kind of reinforce that point. You know, I mean, for me, you know, that moment of 9/11 and the Taliban's, you know, demand and, you know, the American response and the Taliban reaction. It's just, you know, the whole thing should be read, you know, from whatever point of view. So what I find is that audiences quite often come at it and they actually do just see it the way that they wanted to see it already. But I think it's important to recognize it can be
seen from another point of view as well.
Firstly, thank you to Muazzam and the whole team for making the film, which was a real eye-opener. The film, of course, suggests great complicitness of the security services in torture, etc. How should the Muslims and the wider community address this?
One of the things that I did when I came back from Guantanamo, contrary to popular belief, I didn't set up a cage. I was in a cage at the time cage was set up. But it was set up, and when I returned, I found that it had the most comprehensive listing of the Guantanamo prisoners, people being tortured, held without charge or trial, and I saw myself visiting the site several times a day because I wanted to know what happened. I wanted to know the faces that I met, some of them, I didn't know who they were, I didn't know their stories. So part of what the Muslims have done in this community, in this city, in this country, is set up an organization like CAGE that became our voice, it became a focal point, it became a campaigning organization, and it became an idea. CAGE, importantly, became an idea of holding just power to account, seeking justice, seeking to empower the community, and to not be cowed down, to not to be beaten down by people from within the power structures. In fact, we only become stronger. And so that's part of the message again. Think about this, CAGE's accounts have been closed down for 3 years. Directly as a result, after I was arrested and thrown into prison, I was declared innocent, as you saw, that didn't allow our accounts to reopen. There is injustice taking place. And even when they say you're innocent, doesn't mean you're treated in an innocent way. But CAGE's response has been that it became even stronger. Imagine an organization that runs with no bank account becomes stronger in the community of support it receives as a result of being targeted by the security services. This is truly, in my view, it's a miracle. And so part of what I want society to do, that's what I want the Muslim community to do, to support us, to see what we're doing, and to build their own institutions, build this idea of being strong in your identity, strong in your resilience, and firm in your views as long as you believe in them. And what the wider community, because this isn't a Muslim issue. We've been here before, the place where we had, I think, one of the best responses was Belfast, where there wasn't a Muslim in sight. Yet everybody knew what we were talking about. They knew this. They understood the film. They understood where it's coming from. They understood the importance of holding power in check. And so there are people within this country, within this community, who recognize our work. And they get frightened sometimes by sections of the media or within the government, but still, even then, they hold their heads up. So we want to seek to empower communities in plural, not just the Muslims, but others also.
Thank you, everyone, for coming. Jazakallah khair. And like I said, please do keep the conversation going. Like I said, blog, talk about it, email, tweet, whatever you do. And finally, really, I'd say, Muazzam, Ashish, I appreciate your work very much. You know, that you suspended your judgment, you said, were very, very honest and very fair. But Muazzam, I have to say to you, was watching that, I didn't get a chance to come to your father's funeral. But seeing him today, honestly, he would be proud of you. Honestly, you vindicated. He stood up to every one of those journalists and said, I know what Muazzam's about. And that is the best testament, I think. Honestly, watching that film.
If I may, I want to relate one story of my father just to tell you what he was like. In Newsweek magazine, it was reported falsely that I was building drone aircraft. I was going to fill them with anthrax and fly them into the House of Commons building. My father was asked this question by journalists in front of a press conference. And Mr. Beck, what do you say about this allegation that's being made by the Americans against your son? And he responded in ways that few people ever could. He said, you know, if that's true, I'm very proud of my son. And they said, how is it possible, Mr. Beck, you could be proud of something like that? He said, well, you see, the thing is, my son at school was rubbish at physics, chemistry, and biology, and now you're saying he's an expert at all three. That was my dad's goal.
very much.